Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, the show where each week we speak to pharma company owners and industry leaders sharing their stories of personal and professional growth. We're now on series four of the show, and as you may already be aware, we're on a mission to help clinical researchers from around the world with tips, tricks, and inspiration. So if you could do me a quick favor and please hit that follow or subscribe button, it really does help more than you'll ever know. Once again, Adam Walker is alongside me, so sit back, relax, and we'll take things from here. This week, we are joined by Zina Sarif, founder and managing director at Yendu. Zina, I've given you a quick introduction there. Yes. Am I getting your name right? You've got to give me the heads up on that, your surname.
Perfect. It's Zina Sarif.
Perfect. Well, Zina, welcome to the show. If you could perhaps give us a quick intro about Yendu, because I know it's, you know, you're the founder and it's very much a startup, right?
Yes.
If you can give us a quick overview of your role and what the company is all about, because I had no idea when I first reached out to you.
I know. We are a bit not overly branding the company and what we are doing at the moment. First, thank you for inviting me to be here today. Yes, I'm the founder. Like in Germany, we use the word managing director instead of the CEO. Mm-hmm. As long as the company is a certain size, that's where the title is coming from. What Yendu is literally a clinical trials delivery system. What we want to do is to have a place, like a platform where all stakeholders that are involved in clinical trials to be able to connect with each other, to co-create value together. I believe in the power of network in scaling medical value. And I missed this type of technology in clinical research when I joined it. And I realized someone has to do it. And if it's not me, I got to wait for longer than it just jumped ship to make it happen.
Cool. Now, look, I guess probably for me and maybe some of our audience, but mainly for me, I'd imagine. Talk to me about the various stakeholders that would be involved here.
Yes, every clinical trial provider. We are targeting pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies first, CRO maybe second, and so it's going to be clinical trials providers. Sites, mm-hmm. physicians, and patients.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Those are the stakeholders we are targeting at the beginning, at least.
And you described it as kind of almost like a networking platform to bring all of these stakeholders together. So what does this look like in practice? I mean, I'm kind of imagining a weird clinical research business dating site in a way, where everyone comes together and can ask questions. But
yes,
I'm sure I'm way off the mark. So if you can perhaps elaborate on that.
Okay, the network is part of it. I love calling it a marketplace network. Mm-hmm. If you think about technologies that really advance, change the way we behave, mm-hmm. in society, but also advance the speed of the way we run things. For example, Amazon is a marketplace where you have a transaction, you go there because you want to buy things. And then you look for suppliers of what you want to buy, and then you buy from them. Mm-hmm. And in this way, it's like a place where you have a transaction between suppliers and buyers. But at the same time, there is some network effect in it, because our buying decisions are based on indirect communications, people, all stakeholders involved, other buyers of ICE reviews,
right,
that we use as references that help us in our decision making. And the fact that other buyers of ICE reviews, they create value of the suppliers. If the review is good, it means there is more traction going on towards the supplier, and then you and that's where the network effect. The network, so it's a marketplace to enable transaction between pharmaceutical companies and sites and physicians. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's all around booking clinical trials the way you book a room in an Airbnb.
Wow.
For sites. Okay. So this is our first goal.
Fine. So again, correct me if I'm wrong. So I'm thinking along the lines of somewhere like clinicaltrials.gov, where you can find studies and things like this. But you're saying that you can actually, rather than just find an active study and patient numbers and things like that, you can actually find somebody that is looking to run a study, and you could contact them and almost put in your proposal, as it may be, via your marketplace, which is Yendu.
Yes, exactly. Right. It's literally a clinical trials application platform that enables the communication between sites and pharma. Like, if you look at the way clinical trials run today and all the issues, like the biggest bottleneck in clinical trials are patient recruitment. And then you have a lot of technologies around in clinical trials. They are trying to fix this issue. You have patient recruitment platforms, and everything else is what I call a technology tool. Mm-hmm. Like, if you think about APROS, A-Consent, ADC systems, all those systems, they are tools for users to interact with them. But if you think about Amazon or Airbnb or Uber, you never go there to interact with Uber. You go to Uber to interact with the taxi driver. It's like a place you go to have an interaction with someone else. It's like a place to connect two sides. And and as a connector, you create value, because for Uber, for example, you provide a faster ride and ride booking for the ride seeker, and income and it's like access to customers for the driver. And the same thing for Amazon. And this is what we are lacking. And everything that we are having at the moment, it's more digitalizing paperwork. And what I believe is, if we have issues with patient recruitment, what we tend to do is the site is not performing. And the site is not performing, we put pressure on site to perform better. Mm-hmm. And I believe the question should be, if the site is not performing, so as a sponsor, I have to ask myself, how and why did I pick the wrong site? I took the wrong decision, and not the site is doing the job wrong. Mm-hmm. And then if you talk to sites also do not understand. For sites, like, the way they see their role in clinical research is providing care to patients as in form of clinical trials, not as a recruiter for patients. Like, how I'm supposed to say how many patients how can I predict how many patients will come to my site to recruit mm-hmm. them? So I believe most issues we have during the clinical trial, even with protocol amendments, and are issues that have been as symptoms of things that happened during the decision making. Mm-hmm. And the decision-making process of the clinical trial is the clinical trial startup. And that's where there is not much done to fix it. Wow. So that's where I'm coming from. And that's what we want to change.
Wow. So it sounds like what you're trying to do is, accelerate that speed of people getting together and getting the right partners. Adam, it looked like you also had a couple of thoughts on this here, as Zena was explaining this.
Yeah, I mean, Zena, I've worked a lot in early phase clinical trial units, and you're right, the whole principle of Airbnb, I think, works in that every time you've got an empty bed, it's costing that clinical trial unit. And that was the way that we always looked at it, was empty beds equals cost going out the door. All the time the beds, it's a bit, like an occupancy rate, isn't it, with a hotel.
Yes.
Every time you've got someone in the bed, they're charging and they're earning potential. And it sounds like what you're describing is matching sites with access to patients to facilitate those clinical trials. Have I understood that correctly?
It's really actually matching sponsors with sites. That's what we are doing at the beginning. There's a lot of focus on patients. We know that patient recruitment companies work now to recruit patients in oncology, it's not successful. And the reason why, somehow we try to substitute the role of physicians in the cancer treatment equation, which is hard because this might work for some skin diseases, for some dermatological issues. But if you put yourself in the place, in the position of a cancer patient, it's literally you are scared about your life. you are not in the position to make a clinical decision about what is the best therapy for you. So you won't go to your physician and say, oh, I have the C diagnosis, but I saw this ad about this clinical trial. I think I should try it.
Mm-hmm.
No patient will do this. And we see it because a lot of arrangements between patient recruitment vendors and pharmaceutical companies are unsuccessful. It's wasted money and to me, for those matters, we cannot substitute the site. We cannot substitute the physician. If you want to increase patient recruitment, we have to increase awareness for sites. And there's a big issue that there are more clinical trials than sites that are engaging in clinical trials. We haven't been working. And when I say we, I'm always thinking in terms of sponsor, because that's where I spent the last few years. Mm. We haven't really thought about how should customer acquisition in terms of site acquisition should, like, how can we acquire a highly performing sites to work with. And also when we think about diversity, you know, everyone is talking about decentralized clinical trials. And when we talk about decentralized clinical trials, all DCT solutions are literally applications. And mm-hmm. those applications are not decentralized by design. What makes those applications decentralized is the app store. So even this decentralization is not a feature in their design. It's an enablement through all the technologies we have, the devices we have that enable us access to those features.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, what I say, clinical trials are decentralized by design. They are running, like when we talk about phase two and phase three clinical trials, they are running across multiple countries. What we lack is smarter decentralization. Where should we go with the clinical trial to increase patients' access to those clinical trials? Where is the medical need? Now we pick the sites and then we figure out the medical need. We realize, oh, we are in crowded areas with high density on clinical trials and therefore a high dilution of patients recruitment across clinical trials. And to me, that's the issue. That's the problem I want to solve. I want to more democratize access to clinical trials opportunities, so more clinical research sites, to enable them access to data insights, so sites too have access to data that's enabling them to make data-driven decisions. Is this clinical trial the mm-hmm. best for me or not? At the moment, sponsors buy those data to make those decisions. The sites do not have the abilities to do this.
Wow.
I think the other point is though that pharma companies are driven to key opinion leaders and centers of excellence, aren't they? That's where all their effort goes. It goes into where they know they're going to likely hit recruitment goals, but also it's about broadening that funnel, isn't it? It's exactly, all about the recruitment funnel.
Yes.
And making sure that you're going broader and wider outside of those centers of excellence and the places that everyone else is going.
Definitely.
It's a captive market, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I see key opinion leaders are the marketing strategy. And we know that sites performance in oncology, you have 40% of sites not recruiting a single patient. And it's like we have a failure, like we have 40% of sites not recruiting, other 30% underperforming, recruiting less than they committed to. So we have a failure rate over like around 60%. And we still repeat the same mistakes because we hope with the next trial we're going to do better.
Yeah.
And to me is, I believe, I understand the importance of KOL and we want to have them around and we need their expertise also early on to know, is the clinical trial design the right one?
Wow.
But I'm like, the way you diversify your portfolio of investment in the stock market, you diversify your portfolio of sites in the clinical trial. And what I say, 70% of sites are not performing anyway. So let's take 40% ratio and try with new clinical research sites and go places we have never gone. Like the worst thing that will happen, we will end up with the same site performance we had before. But in my experience, recruiting new clinics at AstraZeneca, we had better performance. And also the thing you have to think about, the moment you request the permit to run a clinical trial, the FDA, your patient recruitment clock starts ticking.
Mm-hmm.
And when you work with small practices, the contracting timeline is 4 to 8 weeks. Contracting with hospitals, 6 to 12 months. And then, and to me, it just, we have to think about how can we align business value with like with the patient's value and impact value we want to do. And all this talk around clinical trials, I think our job is to bring cure. Like what patients want the most is cure.
Mm-hmm.
And cure means to accelerate clinical trials. The fact that clinical trials cost $800 million per trial from the start of phase one till approval and 12 years timeline, it's just not how we can advance research. It's like if you need 12 years to update your software on your iPhone, do you imagine where we will be here? We will just get the iPhone 4. So there will be no social media. We won't be here. And this is the reason why we haven't been able to cure cancer or other diseases that are challenging us at the moment. To me, like at the end, all drugs approved now are technologies from the past because it takes that long. And we can only invest in few drugs because at the end, you only have a certain budget for R&D. And if every trial costs you $1 billion, there are so many potential IPs that are on the shelf. And they will never be tested, not because they have no potential, because at the end, which drug makes it to the clinical trial is a business decision.
Mm. So everything for you is about that acceleration and improving that speed by the sounds of things. And clearly you're passionate enough about this that you've gone out to set up this marketplace. And I know it was fairly recently because I've been connected with yourself on LinkedIn for a while, and always saw you as the AZ contact over in Germany and kind of would check in on what you were up to, etc. So at what point did this, because normally it's and I can see it or hear it just from listening to you speak, there's a bit of a frustration there that it shouldn't take this long, right?
Yes.
And at what point was it then that you said, you know what, I'm going to go and do something about it. I'm going to leave AZ, which is, you know, the amount of people that would love to land a gig at AZ or, you know, any sponsor for that matter is astronomical. What drove you to say, I'm going to go and do this?
Knowing that other people don't have the time I have. I have always been, like, you know, I grew up in Morocco and we had two oncology centers in the country.
Right.
And growing up in the capital, like, first, people do not have access to targeted therapy we have here. Mm-hmm. We should know that all those drugs that are in clinical trials today and they have been bringing to sites, it's a privilege of high-income countries. People in my country will never have access to them.
Wow.
And in those countries also, you don't have early diagnostics. So most patients get cancer when they are diagnosed, they are stage 4. And they cannot afford hospital stays. So usually they stay with people they know. So we had many patients staying with us, family members, friend of my dad, friends of friends. And I remember I saw many people dying because the first time I think I was 8 years old, when you see, like, it was my uncle was the first person with cancer I experienced in my life. And they came healthy. And then you see how their head deteriorate within 6 months. Mm. It's just scary. I remember back then I was so scared of getting infected. I didn't want to go to the room where they were, just the wear child thing. And then also realizing, because I grew up in a parent's household where becoming a physician is what your parents want for you. Mm-hmm. But to me, it was realizing that a physician can do anything without access to therapy. Yeah. And to me, it was like the first time where I told my mom, I want to be a researcher and understand
cure cancer. Early on in life that this was a career path that you wanted to go in, because that's been quite rare for us, hasn't it, Adam? A lot of people have kind of found or weaved their way into the industry, but you knew specifically from quite a young age because of, I guess, family circumstances.
Yes,
that you wanted to do and was passionate about it even from way back then.
Yeah, I think you saw it. Like, on the one hand, I grew up religious. I am not, but I grew up in a religious household.
Mm.
And you are educated in, you are in this world to serve others. So literally till today, my biggest fear, what I always say, is to die as an organic waste, not having given back to the community. Mm-hmm. So this is how I look at life. And you just, so to me, it was easy because I feel like it's my job to do something.
That's what you
about
chose
something
it.
Bad.
That's, you know, you were going to go and help make an impact. And then,
yeah, it just, you know, like, it's more, I'm not searching for a passion. It's just like the world has so many problems, and then life exposes you to problems, and then you just have to pick one and then try to solve it.
Yeah.
And to me, I got exposed to people not being able to afford care, and having access to care later on, and seeing them dying, understanding the importance of developing therapeutics. So that's where I came from. Then I studied chemistry, specialized in cancer drug development. How can we make chemotherapeutics having fewer side effects, being more targeted towards tumors? That's where I started. And then gene sequencing, CRISPR-Cas9 technology raised in 2010. So I studied biology on the side, and then specialized in more targeted immunotherapeutics. I use different technologies for targeted therapies. And during my PhD, I become curious about oncology conferences. Usually scientists, they don't take oncologists seriously. It's just like, they know nothing about science. You're going to be bored.
Why not? Look, I generally do not know. So why is that?
It's funny because I think oncologists think the same thing about cancer researchers, that they are so. Cancer researchers is all about the science behind trying to understand the disease and finding targets. And to them, physicians are just an instrument to bring their innovation to the patients.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of, they are not this intellect. You just how academics think.
Right.
And the oncologists are just, cancer researchers are so distant from real life. They just, those dreamers, they are so disconnected from how things work in real life. And I remember I told my boss, I want to go to an oncology conference. He was like, you're going to be bored, but just go there. And they found it fascinating because for the first time, I could see real problems. I have been searching for targets, and then I go there and I see, oh, this target, this drug, I thought is great. Patients develop resistance to it after 12 months. Why? I could use my insights to try to maybe reverse this resistance or delay this resistance. And that's what I criticize sometimes about cancer researchers. We see research as a hobby, and we want to investigate, and then we take our time, and we don't think much in terms of how can I translate those insights to a technology that actually can be used by patients.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have been always fascinated. I think that's where my entrepreneurial mind. And then I started reading more, trying to understand how actually therapies are working in the real world. I just read about them in papers, what are the issues? And I realized, and I remember the first time I saw this, clinical trials takes 10 years back then, into now it's just getting longer and longer. I was so shocked. This understanding that whatever I do in those labs, and I was working 60 hours a week at least, sleeping in the couch in the lab, just like I had this typical scientist life. I was like, it doesn't make any sense as long as it takes so long. Because at the same time, I always loved reading books from Peter Thiel, you know, about the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, and you just see how speed works there and how slow things here are. I was like, we just have to accelerate research. I was like, just innovations build on innovation. If it's this way, it will never change. So I decided to join clinical research. And it's funny because there are rarely cancer scientists as clinical researchers. Usually they are in medical affairs or having different other positions.
Mm-hmm.
And and I got asked by AstraZeneca, why would I want to do this? I was like, I want to understand why it takes so long. I want to understand why it's expensive. And it didn't. So I have been doing, I started as a CRA, I got promoted to lead CRA after 3 months. And then I was really fast to bringing clinical trials faster to side. So I asked my boss, I want to do feasibility too. I want to do more startup. I want to do like from the beginning till the initiation. And I could do a study startup in 2-3 months. And back then it would take more than 12 months. But of course it was really physically and mentally exhausting to do it. Mm. And I remember, and the great thing about it, and the drugs I was working on during my PhD, during my bachelor studies in 2012, were the drugs I have been bringing to breast cancer patients at AstraZeneca. Such a coincidence. It was so amazing to see that it's make its way to phase 3 trials. Anyways, then I knew that there is an amazing drug, great phase 1 data. And I knew in triple negative breast cancer patients, they have a average survival around stage 4, 12 months. And I told my boss, if we ever get the approval for this clinical trial, I want to have it. I knew I am fast. And I just wanted to bring it to patients as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I got to know a patient my age, diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer. And she was a real fighter. It's unbelievable. Those kind of people you see, super inspirational. I'm going to beat cancer, eating mm-hmm. healthy, doing sport, always like this positive mind. And I got really frustrated by how slow we were. Like literally 14 months later, and still the trial didn't make it to the site. And in March, she got released to palliative care. And it's really shocking. We always think about death in terms of we age and we die. And humans are more fearful of aging than of dying because we think somehow it happens at no point of getting older and older.
Yeah.
But then I remember talking to her and she was telling me, Zina, I don't want to die. And I think just understanding how cruel it is when you are mentally fit, but your body is failing you. And it's just a horrible place to be in. And honestly, I felt like I failed her. I could have brought this trial early on. And I remember I just had a breakdown in a meeting about the study that we can't do this. And it was more than I can handle. And at the same time, I was thinking, we could do this faster and faster. Anyways, I had this idea. I tried to implement it within AstraZeneca. I was told it's way too big. We have to make it smaller. I didn't want to make it smaller because I know that incremental innovation never lead to the outcome we want to have. So I started exploring other venues, how to make the idea happen. So I got more involved in the startup world, so the speed of a health tech company founders, how fast you can build a product. And I realized I can make it in 6 months. I really had a good time at AstraZeneca. I still have an amazing relationship to my boss. She follows me on Instagram. So it was like we have this, like really I knew, I was a friend with many executives. It's just like, it was a place I felt like I was really appreciated. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated everyone there. I have many executives, they're like, whenever you are fundraising, please call us first, we want to angel invest. So I still have this relationship, but just to understand, also in my goodbye email to everyone, like, you just have to understand, pharmaceutical companies are not tech companies at the moment. And although I would have loved to build it within AstraZeneca, and they really tried hard to make the environment for me to build it, I must say. And just realizing that I could be, so like, yeah, and literally the same thing I told people at AstraZeneca, technology is going to be the future. Every pharmaceutical company will become a technology company in the future. And I think it makes more sense for me to gather the insight and to have the expertise and build those products, because I think I would be of more value to innovators. I see pharmaceutical companies as innovators, to be honest. They bring this cure and there is a gap. So to me, it's like, okay, this needs to be faster, and it's more important than having a big corp career. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, then you have titles and then what? So that was actually the story, the long story.
It's amazing how you describe that, Zina. I'm just curious because, of course, the last couple of years have seen incredible innovation in clinical trials and in getting drugs to market. You know, COVID has been that accelerator. Do you think, I don't know the answer to this. I don't know whether you know the answer to this, but do you think if brilliant minds were put together in the same manner in which we've experienced in the last couple of years with COVID vaccines, that there could be a cure faster to the people who need it for cancer and oncology?
I mean, my goal is to cure cancer in my lifetime. I hope if I live for 120 years, that I still have around 90 years to make it happen. I truly believe it's possible. And this is my life mission, is to make it happen. I think there are thousands of talented scientists in laboratories. What we need is not more people like me in the lab, but people like me who understand the urgency of research because there is no one, most of us are scientists who understand nothing about technology. So whenever we face problem, we throw money in it in terms of, we try to solve issues that can be automated, so technology with people. Let's build one more team. Let's reconstruct the organization. We're just adding more complexity to it, which makes things more expensive. And I think it's so fun to be in the lab and build things. I love it. And but then I think I am not needed there. Someone needs to build the infrastructure to enable those people to bring those drugs to patients as soon as possible. 100%, 90 years, a lot of things can happen in 90 years.
Wow. So look, I guess coming on to, Yendu and kind of how that's been going. I mean, first of all, where does the name come from? It's not one of, it's unlike a lot of, you know, normally it's something therapeutics or clinical research, or you know, it's but Yendu, I just had no idea, Zina. So you've got to fill us in on where that's come from.
Like my dream is one day people will say, let's Yendu the trial, which means we will accelerate it using the way people say, let's Google it or something. Mm-hmm. Let's Yendu trial. Where the name is coming from is literally Yen for Jennifer and Du for Dudnak. Jennifer Doudna was Nobel awarded for the CRISPR-Cas9 technology. She's a biochemist, and CRISPR-Cas9 is definitely the future of personalized medicine, and that's where I see research is going. Mm-hmm. So having a patient tailored healthcare, and that's what the name from is, like the first three letters from
three and three,
the first name together. Yes.
I like that. Get a couple of names, put them together. It always works. I mean,
yes.
awesome. And so when did this venture for you kick off? How you know? Can you remember the day?
The first day?
What did you do? It was the first day. Do you remember it?
Yes, it was the 29th of September. I was running this feasibility, which wasn't my job. Like literally at AstraZeneca, I was doing so many jobs. So that's why I know whatever you see as a job in LinkedIn, it's probably 20% of what people do in their day-to-day life.
You don't need to tell me I'm a recruiter. I'm just thinking, are they going to be suitable? Are they not going to be suitable? I better pick up the phone and just ask.
Yes. Yeah. And I was running this feasibility for this triple negative breast cancer clinical trial for those patients. And the clinics are frustrated. And I remember the clinics are frustrated. The physicians are frustrated. AstraZeneca is frustrated. I am frustrated. Everyone is frustrated about how it's done. And then I was sitting there, I was thinking, what if we have, like the first idea was literally a dating app. Like, what if we have like a Tinder where physicians can, just after their work, everyone is on their phone, mm-hmm. just go to studies and swipe right or left.
So my thought of the dating app at the top of the show wasn't a million miles off then.
No, that's how it started. This is like, and then after more iterations, and I have no idea about prototyping. Mm. I mean, I am a lab rat. That's how my friends always call me. So I was... And I always have this excitement when I have an idea. So like, I was like, okay, how can I build a prototype? How it would, how it, will look on the phone, how it will look on the desktop, and then I just, and how can they search per indication, how, what will be like built, what can they see? And then I did this. It took me a while because, and then I wrote our country head an email. Hey, his first name. What if we do this like this and this and this? We can do this, this and this and this and this. And then I sent him the presentation, and he replied back. I was thinking about something similar a while ago, and it got fragmented. Unfortunately, you know how the big corp will sometimes work, and ideas, great ideas, got just fragmented. Let's have a call. Invited more people, and so yeah, I have been pitching to. I learned a lot from pitching to first figure out who are the decision maker in a 70,000 people company, and understand people have different incentives. And sometimes the people who you want to make the job easier, they don't want the solution because they are like, there's a lot of fear about technology making people replaceable. And then that's where resistance came from. And then just like knowing whom you should talk to and so on. So I was, and then you have people connecting you to more people, and then how you find your allies that brings you to the right people, and then you start discussing the details and so on. So that's really how it started. And I haven't took any vacation the first year at AstraZeneca, and then I was forced to take a vacation because otherwise it would be like some legal issues. And then I had 1 month vacation. I took the month and did a 1 month programming bootcamp to be able, just like at the same time, I took the month to make the wireframes, to prepare just like how things and figure out. I was running things in parallel. If it won't work with AstraZeneca, I don't want, just like keep moving with the product, talking to other big pharmaceutical companies and see if it's an issue, just do more market research to understand how other companies do it, how other sites think about it. And that's what I have been doing. It was so exhausting because, you're having your 50, 60 hours in big corp. But that's how it started.
How's it going now? So it must be pretty much a year in, right? There or thereabouts.
Yeah. We are in September.
You hit September. Where did that time go? Yes. Blinked and missed it. Oh my goodness,
unbelievable. So it was really just an idea for the first 6 months. Till the end of March, not much happened. So trying to. And then in April, I started really building low fidelity prototype, exactly how every screen, like I had 140 screen, like how every single step should look like for every single user. So I have been working on this. And yeah, I quit my job at the end of May. So actually now 3 months since I am working full time on it. I quit my job. So like my last day.
How's that different? Because I guess going into an organization where there's 70,000 people, clearly they're not all in the one office. But to work in as, an entrepreneur to, try to build a business from scratch. How is it just yourself at the moment? Have you got kind of any?
No, I have a team of seven people at the moment.
Uh-huh.
We are a seven people team. I felt so free. What I missed at AstraZeneca is creativity. I loved, as a scientist, you spend the whole day strategizing about a project, and then you build a drug, you test it. You are in this flow. As painful as it is, you are in the flow all the time. And then now my attention was interrupted all the time. It's like always reacting, which is exhausting. And I just missed having enough focus time to add value. And it was so freeing to be able, because like when I quit, I couldn't wait. Like my head was already 100% with Yendo. So AstraZeneca become a distraction.
Yeah.
And you just want to do your job well, because I love the company and like being responsible. But it felt more like doing something you no longer enjoy doing because your heart is already elsewhere.
So you're very much focused on that. And, that's where the switch came in. And, I guess it's crazy to think that, you know, you've gone from May to now and you've got seven kind of people on board. I mean, how have you done that? Have you had to get investment? Was it savings?
How has it all worked? I sold my car. I got all my money out from the stock market back to my bank account. We are bootstrapping. And luckily also, I quit my job on a Friday. On a Monday, I was like, okay, time to shake off the big cop spirit. Mm-hmm. And there was a hackathon in healthcare starting on Monday. I was like, I'm just going to sign into this hackathon. I never done a hackathon in my life. I signed into this hackathon. I asked a friend of mine who is a developer, and his name is Nick. I was like, Nick, could you join me? Because I want a prototype by Friday. So everyone is have to build something and they do some wireframing. No, I want a product that people actually can click and use. Mm. So the idea was like, I didn't want to enter with Yandu because I didn't know about, you know, ownership of IP and product. So I entered with another idea it was called Clean Option, how to enable patients referral for physicians and patients. And we did it, and I won the hackathon. And the price of winning the hackathon was to enter a health tech accelerator by the EU, which is a no equity accelerator.
Right.
So it's actually the no equity accelerator pay the salary of three people of my team, which is great. And then they offer you, you know, the network, coaching, and all these experts around you, the office. So I kind of got lucky with that. It wasn't planned at all.
Hey, you're going to take it, right? You're going to take it.
Yes.
Everyone would do the same.
Yeah. And then there are those things. You hire the wrong people. You got to fire them, right? And then so many things that I had to learn. But the hardest one was people. Mm-hmm. Honestly, the hardest one was people. When you are an overperformer or when you are alone, you can move fast quickly. And I was used to it. But now you have to get your team with you. So you are slowing yourself down, but then you have to, you know, just like, it was so hard. It's still hard sometimes. I got used to it, or I hate being micromanaged. People love being micromanaged. I didn't know that. And then, you know, talking to other founders, like, you know, you got to micromanage. People need this safety to know exactly what the tasks are. You choose the chaos doesn't mean that people like the chaos too. They can thrive in it. You have to offer them this environment. And, you know, okay, then I needed a project roadmap. Yes?
I was going to say, certain types of people like to be micromanaged. Not everyone.
Certainly,
I don't think a person like you likes to be micromanaged. But you're right. You know, it's a very different skill set being a lab-based scientist or a lab rat to then being a manager of people, isn't it? And driving outcomes through a team of people.
Definitely, yes. And then talking to engineers.
It's a different ball game altogether when you get into that management thing because you can run at 100 miles an hour, but if the team, then you're going to be on your own. So it's just one of those
definitely
things.
Something that
you will learn. But look, with that in mind, you know, what are the plans next? You know, what's next for yourself, Yandu? If we're talking, I don't know, whether it's, you know, kind of the next 90 days, I don't know how far out your business plan goes at the moment, but to paint that picture for us.
It's actually funny because I have a 10 years plan for Yandu. Mm-hmm. I have always been, I need a vision, and then you work it step by step. Mm-hmm. And then you are in the moment, and then it's stormy everything, but then I feel like when you know where you are heading to, and it's like with science in the lab, you are just literally, you had there, you cry in the lab because your experiment didn't work. Turned as you are expecting, and some days, so you just know there are up and downs, and then but you know what the path is, so I'm kind of being used. So the plan now is getting the product launched soon. We are almost there at the finish line.
This year do we reckon
in few weeks even.
Okay,
yes,
we'll be holding you to that one. We'll keep an eye on that one, Zena.
Yes. It's gonna be a soft launch, so we won't put the product on to the public. It's gonna be just between the but it will be launched the end of September.
Wow.
So 1st of October is launch day. And then now we are in conversation with different sponsors. Mm-hmm. To and so that's what's happening.
Go next.
Exactly, that's what's happening at the moment, and then there's fundraising plans after that.
Then you get into that, and then you'll be into that cycle of fundraising.
You know, so exactly. So I'm trying to postpone it as much as long as possible. Talk to users, to customers, understand what they want, and optimize the product, because maybe later on I won't have that much time to do it. So that's the plan.
Best of luck with it all, and I'll perhaps have to drop you a DM to see if everything's gone well with the
launch,
etc. But look, before we close the show, we always finish up with a very quick fire questions round. So look, I'll kick us off with that and just ask, look, what is the number one piece of advice that you'd perhaps give to your younger self?
I am so proud of my younger self, to be honest. I think, you know, the funny thing, I was saying, a friend of mine, whatever I will do in life, it won't be as impressive as what my younger self did, because I grew up in a bad environment, and where usually people like me won't be where I am here today. Mm-hmm. So I totally admire the 10 years old me who had a plan, was resilient enough to think there is hope, and then she can get myself out of this environment. And I don't know how my past self did it, but yeah, I would say, yeah, nothing
do
to
it,
say
do
to
it
my
again
then
is the advice then.
Yeah. What about flipping it on its head? What would the advice of your younger self be to your current self then? Because it sounds like that was a very wise
Yes.
person.
Yeah,
had.
I wish I could talk to my, yes, this is, you know, I would always ask myself this question every day when I am in doubt. It's okay to fail. Long term, you will be right, and it's okay if you fail short term. That's okay to make mistakes.
Yeah. I like that. And actually, thanks, James. talking about failure, you know, one of the mantras I have is failure is success turned inside out. I remind myself of that sometimes, and actually through failure you learn. And you build that resilience that you've described. Thank you for clarifying that. What is the number one book or resource you would recommend for our audience? Because they're always keen to learn from learned people like yourself. Is there something on your bedside? I have a feeling there's quite a heavy stack of books on your bedside.
Oh my God, you see all my books there?
Well, I don't know whether that's your bedside, but certainly I think you're a reader.
No, this is my bookshelf. Yeah, I have a blog, it's called zinasarif.com, and I always publish my reading list of every year. Ooh. Because my fans always read my recommendations, so I am the book recommendation provider. I would recommend a book that has nothing to do with entrepreneurship. And the book, it's called The Curse of Love by Alain de Botton. I truly believe that it's about relationships, and I think everything in life is about relationships. People do not understand it. They think also networking is taking and giving. I love saying that everyone is a giver, and that's how it works. And and Alain de Botton is such an amazing inspiration in terms of what empathy means, and understanding how humans are, and that we are just children in grown-up bodies, and then some. We have the rights to our irrationalities, and yeah, so definitely The Course of Love by Alain de Botton.
Awesome. And look, I mean, you've already built a team. I didn't expect that there would be such a headcount at this early stage, having started in just May.
I know.
So look, what are the top three qualities that you value most? I mean, what have you been looking for when you've put this team together, if you're to name just three?
Yes, kindness. To me, is the first, it's most important thing ever. This is how you make sure that you don't have a toxic culture. To me, to be kind, being a hard worker, I believe that hard work triumphs over talent. Mm-hmm. It's great if you are a talented person, but better talented than hard worker, mm-hmm. or hard worker without a talent. And the third one is being purpose driven,
having that focus.
Yes. Some people, they have just the drive that they want to build something for others. They want to do something for others. And there are people who want to do things because that's what society taught us how career works. And yes, and I like people who build things for others.
Awesome.
It sounds like, listening to what you said earlier, you know, manifesting and vision boarding and calling it for what it is and having that plan is really where you have your focus. You keep your laser focus, if I'm hearing you
yes.
correctly.
You know, it's funny because
you got a vision
here.
Board there.
No, I have no vision board. This is my old plan. This is my 30 years professional path in cancer research. And people would all, my dream was to become the CEO of Novartis. It's actually
it's still
funny.
Time. There's still time.
Because I have always thought how like if you want to impact people's lives, you want to impact as many lives as possible. And CEOs of companies decide what on the portfolio, on the pricing, all the stuff. And maybe being in this position might help me make the world better for cancer patients. And I am not like literally, but like a whole career in corporate. I believe it's really important to have a plan because that's how you recognize opportunities, because opportunities are often outliers.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have a plan, you don't know. But if you have a plan, you recognize the outlier and you think this shouldn't be on this path. So I might have give it a bit of attention and assess if it's worth following or not.
That takes the entrepreneur's eye, doesn't it? It's that risk-taking gene in us, I think, that spots the outlier. There is a book, by the way, you've reminded me of called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. I don't know whether you've come across that. That is a magnificent book. You just reminded me. But anyway, what is your favorite thing outside of work? I digress.
I love running. Yeah, I love running.
How far? Are you a long distance?
Are we sprinting? Are we mid distance? Marathon?
Okay. Oh, both. It's hard to stop me when I start. There was a time I would be running 72 kilometers a week, and now I have less time to do this. So I love sprinting. You're just feeling the power of the body. I think it's just something powerful because I use my brain all the time. Mm-hmm. So it's just nice to feel your body in physical power. And I like also just going on long runs and mostly listening to Stoic philosophy and Taoism stuff and then reflecting on life. That's what I do when I go on long runs.
Awesome stuff. And look, I guess on that note then, you know, listening to Stoic philosophy, etc. I mean, what would you say is your number one golden rule for life and business? Last final question here.
You know, Maya Angelou says that when you die, the thing that people remember about you is how you made them feel.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal in life is when people remember me, they remember that they felt loved, appreciated, and that they mattered.
I like it. Well, Zena, thank you very much for jumping on with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Looking forward to hearing more about, you know, even the soft launch and how things go. But look, for anyone perhaps wanting to reach out to you to learn more, what's the best way to get hold of you?
I mean, definitely on LinkedIn. I'm responsive maybe less than I used to be, but yes, on LinkedIn, Zena Sarif, or yeah, that's actually where you... This PM is
IBM. Or out on the running track.
Yes.
Awesome stuff. Well, Zena, been an absolute pleasure. Thanks again for being on the Huxley Morton podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Adam and James. Wish you a great day.
Thanks.